Hi, good afternoon. My name is Elaine Charnoff, and I'm the Director of Education Programming and Exhibitions here at the New York Public Library. And on behalf of the library, I really wanted to welcome you today. How fabulous to get such a great crowd on a Saturday afternoon. So we're delighted. I just wanted to say a few brief words about the library. As many of you are probably aware, we cover three boroughs, from Staten Island to the Bronx to Manhattan, including 91 different venues, four research libraries, and many, many branch libraries. Over the course of each year, we actually have about 44 million visitors when you think about combined, you know, on-site experiences and, of course, with all new media technologies, online experiences. So it's pretty extraordinary. And one of the things that we're particularly proud of are our on-site experiences with fabulous librarians, fabulous resources that really help provide a range of knowledge and resources, you know, to people like yourselves and really people across all communities, all generations. And in addition to the resources, we're also very proud of our public programs and our lifelong learning opportunities, because there too is a great opportunity to build educational experience and also new kinds of communities. And that's one of the reasons why we're delighted to be hosting you today, because it helps bring another very solid community here to the library. And lastly, just wanted to say that we really hope that you will use and continue to use the library to feed your imagination and spark your passions, both in your personal and your professional pursuits. So with that, I'd like now to welcome Alexandra Kent, who is the director of the Purpose Prize. Thank you.
Welcome. How are you today? Good. Nice crowd. Well, I want to first start by thanking the New York Public Library for having us all here today. As the director of the Purpose Prize, I'm thrilled to be here with those of you who are taking steps to learn about Encore careers. At Civic Ventures, where I work, we discuss Encore careers as being work that combines meaning, social impact, and income in the second half of life. So before we dive in to meet our panelists for the day, each of whom are going to speak a little bit about both the rewards and the challenges of finding work that matters in later life, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the Purpose Prize. So the prize was started 3 years ago by Civic Ventures, a think tank that focuses on boomers, social impact, and work. The Purpose Prize awards up to $100,000 to 15 social innovators over 60 every year. So while the prize is an investment in what each of the winners will do next in their specific area of interest, such as education, the environment, poverty reduction, it's also a way to highlight stories of people over 60 who are putting their passion to work for the greater good. So the two speakers that will be here in our first panel that have been honored by the Purpose Prize, they're both social entrepreneurs who created their own Encore careers. However, I'd like to point out that there are millions of people who have embarked on various pathways to start their own Encore career. Some people go back to school to retrain to be a teacher or a nurse. Others may transition from the corporate sector into the nonprofit sector, help with things like marketing, human resources, accounting. And we've even had people who are looking for a part-time income and who start out either volunteering and maybe getting a job tutoring in a school 15 hours a week. So Civic Ventures recently completed a survey, and we found that there were tens of millions of adults ages 44 to 70 who are interested in finding an Encore career. And the most popular areas of interest were working with youth, protecting the environment, and becoming an advocate for an issue that they cared about. And I'm even lucky enough to say that when I was a young student in high school at a public urban school in San Francisco, I met a volunteer named Lyndon Berry, who at the time was in her 50s. And she had been a writer and wanted to help young people apply to college. I was one of those students, and what I really love about Lyndon was that she took the time to come and meet with me weekly and a few other students on campus. And I found out that when I graduated from college, she had actually decided to go back to school. We graduated at the same time. And she's now a therapist working part-time in the San Francisco Public Schools with teens and runs therapy sessions for young women. So she's basically earning a paycheck and doing something she loves. So with that, I'd like to start our program by showing a couple of films today. They're very brief. The first one highlights attendees at a recent Encore Career Summit, and the second profiles a recent Purpose Prize winner. So with that, I'd like to start our film.
There's a movement afoot, and our generation's been a part of a lot of movements, but I'm a younger baby boomer, so maybe I wasn't on the vanguard of that one, but I have an opportunity to be on the vanguard of this one.
As far as trying to describe an encore career, I probably would say something like, well, you know what you did when you were 40, you knew what you did when you were 50, you know what you did when you were 60, so now you're going to be 70, 80, and 90, so you can have another career.
What I'm doing now, what is different now, is that I'm using my experience to help save some lives. If I can save even one life, because of my dedication, I will be very happy.
Well, I've become an environmentalist in my encore career. And that is the interesting thing about me, is that I never saw myself as a person to go down and get in the garden and do grassroots, picking up weeds out of the gardens and organizing farmers to bring food down to a farmer's market.
The person who inspired me the most was my father. When he retired, he was able to lead such a vibrant and fulfilling life because he was so engaged in the community.
I really resent the stereotypes of aging in this country. It's just nonsense. And I don't think about it because it doesn't apply to me as far as I'm concerned.
I think the future of this country is going to depend largely on its history. And as our country ages, we're going to have a great reservoir of wisdom.
We train mental health care workers, indigenous workers from around the globe to deal with their victimized populations, and then we establish trauma treatment systems within those countries.
To date, we have treated more than 75,000 people around the world. I am energized by this. I feel most alive when I am in rural Uganda and rural Rwanda, and I know I'm going to just have a ball in Haiti.
I was a participant last year also, and I could not believe the number of people who were doing extraordinary things. And so over the last year, I've watched that expand. I keep telling my friends that they just don't believe all the things that are going on in this underground of encore work.
Oh my God, it was amazing. I've never been with such an inspiring bunch of people, and I spend my life with inspiring people.
This is the opportunity to change the world, to go everywhere, to disperse out into the world, and to share what we have, which is tremendous gifts.
The original meaning of broadcast in this country is to scatter seeds. And what this summit is doing is scattering seeds. And during this time here, we've all heard wonderful ideas, and some of them are taking root and will take root in our minds and souls as we go on from here. And what can be more satisfying, more invigorating, more wonderful than that?
Thank you. Born in rural Mexico, Catalino Tapia arrived in the United States at the age of 20 with $6 and a sixth grade education.
I work on a lot of different jobs. I was a baker earning 45 cents an hour. And then I went in planting plants for nurseries. And I decided to be a gardener. So I started very small. And all of a sudden, I had plenty of customers. My wife and I always had on mind education for our kids. And I told them, whoever wants to go to school, don't have to worry about work or anything. I will provide whatever it takes.
When years later, Catalino's son, Noel, graduated from law school, a lifelong dream was realized.
We were just jumping up and down, and I didn't know that I was alive. I had to pinch myself to be sure that I was alive. That was a blessing from God. From that point on, I had on my mind to do something to help other kids continue with their dreams. And all of a sudden, I had this idea, the clients.
He came to me one day and talked to me about this wonderful idea of helping children of gardeners be able to afford to go to college.
I thought he was a little crazy at first. I didn't think he could make it go, but he's very determined, and he had a cause, and it was going to happen no matter what.
With seed money from his clients, Catalino launched the Bay Area Gardeners Foundation to provide scholarships for low-income students seeking higher education.
Our students work on the average 30 to 35 hours a week, but at the same time, they're struggling to take 9, 10, 12 units. And it's that $150 or the $500 that Catalino's foundation can bring to bear that makes the difference between being able to buy their books and stay in college where they belong. He's one of these extraordinary leaders who never, ever gives up.
Well, I work 20 hours a week and I am a full-time student. It's difficult to go through my education path by myself. So with the support of Don Catalino and his foundation, helps me keep moving forward. I want to become a civil engineer and one day be able to serve my community. I want to get my bachelor's degree and possibly my master's one day.
I'm studying to be a double major in mass comm and political science, just so I can later go on to graduate school in journalism and maybe even start my own fund like Catalino.
Anybody can apply for the scholarship. We don't see color, we don't see race.
Thank you.
We see the need for the kids to continue with their education. And it's not only the economical support, but the moral support is just as important to tell the kids, you know what, I don't even know you, but I'm behind you. The future belongs to you, and the horizon is ahead of you. Don't look back. Go forward all the time.
He has been able to forge fabulous relationships with business owners, with corporate America, with foundations, and engage them in the education of children of gardeners who we often forget and we ignore.
On the garden, you plant a seed and it germinates and grows and bears fruit. That's what we are doing with students. And someday they will realize that education is the key to open a lot of doors in the world, and that means that seed had germinated and they will bear fruit for their family, fruit for their future, and for the upcoming generations.
For the extraordinary contributions he's making in his Encore career, Catalino Tapia wins the 2008 Purpose Prize.
How about that? I actually am very proud to say that we have two of the people featured in these films here today to be on our first panel. I'd first like to introduce Liz Alderman, who is formerly a teacher and also a stay-at-home mom who, in her Encore career, helped to found the Peter C. Alderman Foundation. I'd like to welcome Elizabeth to the stage. And I'd also like to welcome Catalino Tapia, who was featured in the second film. He is the founder of the Bay Area Gardeners Foundation. Please come on up. And I'd lastly like to introduce Jerry Sedler. She is the author of Don't Retire, Rewire. She's also a member of the conference board, and she helps advise them on the mature workforce. And she's also on the Encore Leadership Network with Civic Ventures and helps to promote the Encore career. Jerry.
Thank you, Alex. Okay. Well, are you ready to get rewired? Are you ready to know more about how can you learn from these two outstanding individuals about what might be in your future? Because I noticed the line up here on one of the films that said there's more to do, and all I could think about was dot, 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 and it's up to you. And that, to me, is the exciting thing. Now, before I sit down and start the interviewing, I just want to say a few words. And that is, one, we know that we're going through challenging times. It's a reality. It's out there. We will come through it. So I have been telling people that, one, rewiring does mean rerouting energy, but it also begins with rerouting your mindset, changing your mindset. How many of you think you're adaptable people? Ah, much opportunity here. I didn't see every hand go up. Flexible, agile. These are the words for the future. So when I begin to tell people that you have got to look at the world with a new set of eyes, that's why it's so great to start with the film where you're looking, I truly believe it. But I know for a fact that when you walk out of here today, the BlackBerry, the cell phone, the bus, whatever on Fifth Avenue is going to distract you. So when I tell you, as you begin to think about change and transition in your lives, finding that Encore career, when I say you need to look at the world through a new set of eyes, a new lens, I am not kidding. Now, I know that these are horrible, but the reality is you're going to remember that I'm telling you that you have got to begin to look at the world differently, and also you've got to begin to look inside, because that is exactly what Catalina and Liz have done. They looked inside, and that is one of the things that as a society we don't always do. You need to take an inward journey before you can start what I call that outward journey. Is there anybody in this room who is hesitant at all about looking at the world with a new set of eyes? Anybody who think, I saw hands back there? I want you, could you please pass these back? And do you know, as I travel around the United States and do this, every single person who has raised their hand has worn glasses. So this, but that is my point. So as you sit here and listen to what we're going to talk about today, get no editing. These are real people. These are us. That's what I'm really getting at. It's not unique measures. It's doing things with passion, with purpose. As Alex said, that's what it's all about when you think about that next act. Now, I want to get a little bit of a show of hands here. How many of you are in transition right now? Okay. How many of you are waiting for a shoe to drop and you think you might be in transition? Okay. And how many of you are really open to experiencing maybe a totally different type? Wonderful. I'm saying this so Liz and Catalino and I and Michael later really get a sense of where you are. We're going to drill down on some ideas, and also there's an index card. That's how we want to do the questions, because we want to get as many questions answered. So put those, you know, questions down there. Alex will be feeding me as we go through the program. And also at the end, we will be then even raffling off to some of you, the books are definitely here in the library, and we're so proud to be here today at the library, but we'll raffle a book or two off later so you can get some ideas. But one of the key things as you listen also, and it's something that I believe in and it's a part of the book, it isn't just about your competencies or your skills or your accomplishments or what's on that resume, but it's also understanding yourself. Because there's a big question. How many of you know what motivates you? Beyond money. When we did the research, we found out 85 reasons for why people said they work beyond the money. It's real important to know yourself. These two individuals do. So let's begin. All right, let me join you over here. Now, in the film, I feel like this is really one of those morning TV shows. I'm liking this. Okay.
But not as early.
Not as early. Absolutely right. Okay. I want to begin, and it's with Liz. The film touched on a little bit, showing you there, but I want to know more about the organization. I want to know why you are here today. What in your life brought you here?
Okay. First of all, I'm very, very happy to be here, and thank you all for coming. I did jot down some notes because I have about 5 minutes to tell you about the work that we've done, and it's wide and it's broad, and I really didn't want to leave certain things out. I think the main reason I'm here today is to tell you that you have the power. You have more power than you can possibly imagine. And if you can combine the power that you have with passion, you can accomplish anything. You can change the trajectory of your life. You can even change the trajectory of the world. And I know this because of my own story. We were a very ordinary family. I was a special education teacher for 8 years. And then I felt truly fortunate to be able to be a stay-at-home mom. And I loved being a mom. I knew nothing about business or philanthropy. And then my whole world fell apart. My youngest child, Peter, was murdered on September 11th, 2001. He was attending a conference at Windows on the World at the World Trade Center. He didn't work in the building, and he was 25 years old when he died. Although Peter no longer existed, as a mom, I still had that need to do for him, and I really struggled to find a way to honor his life. About 8 months after his death, I learned that there are 1 billion people, 1/6 of humanity, had directly experienced torture, terrorism, or mass violence, and that more than 40% of these survivors were no longer able to lead functional lives because of traumatic depression and PTSD. They can't work or care for their families. Children can't attend school. Many can't even leave their beds. There was nothing I could do for Pete. Pete was killed because of terrorism. But if I could help those people that had survived the event but were still unable to live their lives, then this was the perfect memorial for Peter. Peter truly cared about life. My husband, my daughter, and I have dedicated our future to rebuilding post-conflict societies by returning victims of terrorism and mass violence to productive lives. The Peter C. Alderman Foundation is on the front lines every single day. Since 2003, we have trained more than 144 indigenous doctors and other healthcare professionals from 19 countries on 4 continents. They, in turn, have trained an additional 400 healthcare workers. Our foundation has also opened 6 Peter C. Alderman trauma treatment centers in Africa and Asia. And by March, next month, by March 2009, we will have opened 2 more. And this is only the beginning. The foundation has partnered with the Republic of Uganda to help return 30,000 abducted child soldiers to school and productive lives. We have also partnered with the government of Rwanda and Partners in Health to help people living with HIV/AIDS. Recently, we were able to assist 2,700 displaced Kenyan refugees and enable them to return to their homes when it was safe. To date, more than 75,000 victims have been treated in foundation-run clinics or by foundation-run personnel. The need is everywhere and growing as war and civil strife continue to make headlines around the world. Make no mistake, in sub-Saharan Africa, more people suffer from incapacitating depression and PTSD than from HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria combined. The opportunities for individuals to get involved and make a difference are unlimited. I always tried to teach my kids that they could make a difference in this world, and since Peter's death, I have come to know that this is true. I really believe that if you have the passion to do something, you can accomplish it. You don't need a vast experience. You don't need $1 million. We had neither when we started, only the passion to leave a mark for Peter, that he existed on this earth. We have accomplished far more than we originally anticipated, much more than we ever thought we could do. Through very hard work and a lot of on-the-job training, we are now sought out by governments around the globe. Our new partners and friends are governments, ministries of health, universities, and indigenous religious institutions. We were surprised and very pleased to learn that starting off as a mom-and-pop, really, organization, Barron's Magazine listed us as one of the most effective small charities in America in November 2007. And all of this started because of the power of our dream. I'm telling you my story of what we have been able to accomplish in the hopes that will be an inspiration for you to dream and then to pursue those dreams. Life has many challenges, and it isn't easy. We all face disappointment, frustration, and loss. But I hope you remember during those times that there is nothing naive about your impulse to change your life. You need to know that you have that power. We should all commit ourselves to following our hearts and doing what we love most, and this will be a guide for what we want to do in life. I hope whatever you choose to do, you do it with passion, purpose, and principle. Thank you.
Five minutes.
Thanks. No, you did. Thank you, Liz. I want you to think you, it was interesting because when you were, used the word dream, and but Liz's life has taken a direction now because of something that occurred that was outside of her control. And I'm sure in the time period before you started the foundation, there was much sadness, denial, anger, angst. We went through it. We will all have those type of emotions, regardless of whatever happens to us. But the reality is you identified something. You really went forward. And I think that's what's so important as each of us sit here and listen to think about what might be in our life. Looking at things differently, and think about from a teacher in doing something very similar in a way, but you've totally changed your audience. So in a way, she's taken that competency and the skill and what she had done before, started an organization and openly admitted, I didn't know anything about philanthropy, and I didn't know anything from the business standpoint. So make sure, as I was saying, that you're not listening and allowing things to creep into your own mindset. Because the reality is, if you had done that, you would not be at the head of this organization today, nor would you be impacting the lives of many. So get out of your own way. Now, we had a wonderful film, and so we have a lot of an idea of what has gone on in Catalino's life and how he's impacted others. So you do have a good sense of his organization today. So I want to go back a little bit. And when I first met Catalino briefly out in California at the Purpose Prize, he was honest. And when he said, when I came to this country, I want to know a little bit, Catalino, about from the immigration standpoint. I think that the group would find that interesting when you came to the United States. But also how you really use the immigrant experience and your resources to become the person you are today and to have this unbelievable Gardeners Foundation.
Well, first of all, hi, everybody. Hi, New York. What an honor for me to be here And I wanted to thank God, Civic Ventures, Alexandra Kent, Jim Emmerman, and Mark Friedman for giving me the opportunity to be here with such a nice people. Thank you. First of all, I wanted to say that my father was assassinated when I was 8 years old. And I still remember his love and kindness for his children. And he always taught me to have love and respect for everybody. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough time to learn more about his heart. But I think he's gave me his heart, because to do what I'm doing right now, it takes passion, love, and heart. On 1964, I decided to come and visit our neighbors up on the north. And when I arrived to Tijuana, I was wondering, and I used to look at the border, and I say to myself, one day I'm going to be able to cross that border. So I applied for a temporary passport that it was good only for 8 hours. So I lived in Tijuana for 6 months in order for me to get that passport. But when I crossed the border, I immediately became an illegal immigrant, because I jumped on the train and it took me to LA, from LA to Redwood City. And it was very hard for me to come to a country with a different culture, different language, and without knowing anybody, and how to approach to get a job. And it took me like 3 months to really get a job, and it was on Palo Alto. What a coincidence. I was making donuts, and then I was earning 45 cents an hour. But I was happy, because down in Mexico, I didn't have nothing, because the irresponsibility of my older brothers, they spent every peso they had. So that's what forced me to mature earlier and make the move to come up here. And I wanted to thank this nation, because it's such a great nation and has given me so much that I think it's time for me to give back. And to give back to me is like helping the upcoming generations, the young students, to continue with their dreams of higher education. And that way themselves, one day they can be a more productive citizen for their nation. And today I found myself here in New York in front of such a nice audience and wonderful people that sometimes I ask myself, what are you doing there? You know? Because I don't have a formal education. I never went to school. When I first came here, I was so busy trying to build my family's future. And now I find myself trying to build somebody else's future. And so there is no time for me to go to school, because I work 8 hours on my job. And then after my regular work, I start with the foundation. So I need days with 48 hours to comply with all my commitments. But I'm doing it with my heart, and I'm going to continue doing this for the rest of my life.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. Now, as you're sitting here and listening, you can see it's been an unbelievable selection, because people who are achieving dynamic, unbelievable things, but for two totally different areas. And I would assume that for all of the audience members here today, you have some goals, but you're all going to be coming at it in a different way. So one size does not fit all. But I think one of the key things here in Catalina on thinking, there's a famous line that says WIT. That's how I want people to do things. And WIT stands for whatever it takes. So all of a sudden, he didn't know what was going to be on this other side. He knew that he had a pass for 8 hours to come here to do some shopping, basically, and knew. That's where many of us get some time. Well, it's the how. How am I going to do it? I've got this resume. Where do I go next? To be creative and to think about it. So before we take, and I hope you're writing down any type of, you know, questions for us and everything, but before we get to that part, I want to go back, Liz, and you could have decided to do many things in Peter's name, I'm assuming. Why did you select this arena?
It's a question we get asked very often, that there are so many problems in this world today. Hunger and poverty and disease, why did you choose mental health? Two reasons. One was because it was for Pete. Peter cared about life and he cared about people. And he was killed because of terrorism. And there were people who had survived but still weren't functioning. And if we could bring these people back to life, that was the perfect.
So Peter himself was not in mental health.
No, not at all. But there's a much larger answer, which we have learned. We didn't know this when we started, but we've learned as we've spent time growing the foundation. We believe that mental health is basic to everything. That there's wonderful work being done with HIV/AIDS and malaria. If people don't care whether they live or die, they are not going to adhere to the very difficult regimens that are required in taking those drugs. They're not going to put down that bed net at night to protect them from malaria. Also, if people don't care whether they live or die, they're not going to walk that extra mile for potable water. They'll just drink whatever water is sitting in the cistern in their village next to their hut. Wonderful things are being done with microfinance to help people around the globe get on their feet. But if people can't get out of bed, they can't take advantage of any of these opportunities. So we believe that we are in a niche that is not being filled. There are very, very few people that are dealing with mental health, and we're trying to deal with it in a very professional, scientific way, with scientific methodology, and to try to bring these people back to function so that they can partake of these other opportunities that others are offering them.
Okay. I was just curious because, as we all know, I was wondering, was this a passion of yours to begin with?
No.
So it was not. So, I mean, I think listening too is that sometimes it's not something that's always in our DNA that leads us into a certain direction. So I guess you really do have to look around.
And people don't always completely understand it. When we talk about depression, we're not talking about depression where somebody's, you know, is down with work, they're not very happy about what they're doing. We're talking about incapacitating depression, where people cannot function. And the amazing thing is that 90% of these people can be brought back to function. This is what studies have shown. So it's a hard sell, mental health, but it is what's necessary.
All right. Catalina, going back and thinking then about, Liz just left off and said that mental health is a bad sell. Have there been any obstacles or anything that you had to overcome to really create the foundation?
Well, let me tell you, it hasn't been easy. First of all, I didn't have any experience on fundraising. I didn't have any money, but I had the idea. So I went to Cañada College in Redwood City so that they can help me to write the petition letter for my clients. And once I had that letter, I started sending them through my clients. And within 2 weeks, we raised $10,000. And I say, my God, I'm on the right way, you know. So this is what I'm going to do. But those are the little things that I confront to create the foundation. And then I remember one time this radio station made me. They told me and they say, what has been the most difficult thing for you to do right now? And I said, well, to convince my own people, my friends, and my community, because especially the Latino community, they don't think about anybody else, most of them. They think about their, you know, themselves to make money and to build their future, I believe. But they don't realize how many kids, how many young students are behind them, and they need a lot of support. And just last year, I went to a lot of different merchants on my Redwood City, and they have started to believe. So they came to my event. We do fundraising dinners once a year, and we had 420 people. And I was so happy, so many merchants, politicians, lawyers, and all kind of people like that lady mentioned on the video, that I said, well, God is providing. And so last year we sponsored 16 students with $1,500 each, and two special awards for the most deserving students of $1,000, which is called Book Fund. And this year we're gonna sponsor 20 students with five special awards. Okay. So all the problems are behind now. And even though this, on the way the economy is right now, there is so many people out there with huge hearts that wanted to help, because like myself, they think that education is the key to these students for a better future and a better life and a better world, because one day they will provide this nation.
The next, I mean, and certainly from Encore Careers, we know how many people are contemplating going into back to teaching or going into teaching as well. Let me ask you a question. Would you have thought you were such a great salesman or marketer?
Well, I think people has believed in me because I'm doing it with my heart more than anything else. And just to let you know, it's not that I'm going to brag about this, but the prize that I won from Purpose Prize, my wife and I decided to donate it to the foundation. I told my wife, you know, we are on our way back, and I don't think that we're going to use this money, but I know who can use it. So we donated to the foundation, and that means a lot of more kids are going to receive more scholarships.
That's wonderful. I didn't know where Catalina was going on this. I was wondering if he was going to say, so my wife and I decided we're buying a new little Mercedes convertible. I was going to say, that blows the whole image right there, doesn't it? Okay. Liz, I want to, I mentioned it standing up here that we're motivated by incidents, activities in our lives. But what would you say has really been your drivers, your set of drivers to keep you going? Why are you doing this? Peter is obviously one, but we know it's taking a toll. You're always traveling. And
the motivation has evolved as time has gone on. It started with this real need to leave a mark that Peter existed, and that because he existed, this world's going to be a better place. But as time went on, it became more than just about Peter. As we started to meet the doctors who have given their lives to helping their countrymen, for example, a doctor in Rwanda has gone through the same trauma that their patients have. So every time they're treating somebody, they're feeling that pain again. So it's incredible admiration for the doctors. It's actually meeting the people that we're helping. I mean, last July I was in an IDP camp, an internally displaced persons camp in northern Uganda, of people who were victims from the Lord's Resistance Army. And I didn't think my heart could break any more than it had already broken. But seeing how these people have to live, I mean, and we do outreach into these camps. There are a lot of child soldiers who were returned there. So the motivation started because of Pete. It grew beyond Pete. And I just want to say one other thing about it is that a very large study was done in 1984 on an IDP camp on the Thai-Cambodian border. And they found out that three things helped people recover from trauma independent of any treatment at all. And that was work, altruism, and spirituality. And we learned about this long after we had started the foundation. But we realized that this applied to us. And I think it applies to anybody who's going through very difficult times. The work for me initially was a reason to get out of bed every single morning. And when you're sitting at the computer, you can't cry. You get the keys wet, you can't see the screen. It was allowing me to function at a very high level. So the work was incredibly important. The spirituality, everybody can take that any way that it personally suits them. And the altruism is coming from a place where I never thought I was ever going to feel good about anything again. I really feel good about the people that we're helping. So in a sense, though you never recover from, or at least I will never recover from losing my child, you can have a fulfilling life. You can feel good about things that you're doing.
I very much appreciate that, because this goes back to when we talk about motivators. Obviously, to make a difference is very strong motivators here. But to know your own, as you think now about earning a living, getting another career, are you really driven by a sense of accomplishment or belonging or creativity or problem solving? Or I'm even going to say recognition, leadership, power. Those are all things that fit into the work we do, the difference that we want to make. And that's what I call the softer side of that job search. But it is such an important factor. And I think it's one that we always don't look at and take that inward journey. And obviously, the two of them have, because there are many obstacles, a lot of confrontation. And I think that's probably a little bit about what a lot of you are going through right now, seeing some of the questions I have here. I'll probably have to get my glasses for some of these questions. That's the reality here. Now, the first one, I guess, is the blanket one, where people say, well, how about those of us who must earn a living? And that's, you know, everybody, both of these guys came out of the gate saying they weren't the millionaires. They really said, how are we going to make this happen? They believed in it. And in both instances, you found a way. So that's the beginning, and I guess it's the resourcefulness. When I heard you say, Catalina, I hadn't realized that you went to the community college, basically, to help somebody help you write the proposal. I guess I want to ask, how many of you, in terms of looking for a new way, to have really gone back to what I call some of the traditional methods? How many of you have been really out of the box in looking for new jobs? Just call out real loudly. What's an out-of-the-box you've been doing? You. And thinking differently as an activist. He's coming after it. There is not going to be one blanket answer. I think in the past, And please, the two of you, I want you to, you know, jump in on this as well. There is not one flat answer. And I think that's the unique thing today and the positive thing. You've got your competencies, you have your skills. It's the beginning of to say, I might have been doing this in a certain area, but what might be a new arena? As I said earlier, Liz was the teacher. You were at home then. But she still had the desire to make a difference, to teach, to mentor, to coach. Think of all the things that a teacher is. But what she did, she could have gone to work for a nonprofit and begin to do something like that. And that we will touch on that in the next panel. But I think what you did is you started the foundation. You found something creative, and you employ people also in this. So she herself is an employer doing
this.
Very few. Very few. But, you know, small companies start that way. Catalino, I guess I'm going to say, too, is there anything when you have seen, because you're from the state of California, that going through a lot of issues. If you have the question, what about those who have to earn a living?
Well, let me tell you, I have a perfect example. One of the students that we sponsored, she's attending Mills College in Oakland, and she's paying between $45,000 and $42,000 a year. And her parents, they don't have any money. How is she doing it? On the weekends, she sells tamales, and she organizes dinners out of her parents' home to earn money to pay for her college. So that's a perfect example of what people can do to succeed, to continue with their dreams. And can you imagine how many tamales she has to sell to pay $45,000 a year? And like myself, when I came here, I was making 45 cents an hour. But at the same time, my wife and I had the vision of saving. We used to save as much as we could to pay for our kids' school. So when my youngest son decided to go to college, we had the money to pay for college. He went to UCLA and he received his degree on international economics. And then one day he came out to us and said, well, I wanted to be a lawyer. I said, what? More money? And, you know, we were so happy and so proud of him that we say, well, if that's gonna, that's what you're going to do, that's what you're going to have to do. And you don't have to worry about all the expenses. We can work two or three different jobs to pay for school. And he did it. And when he received that diploma, his degree, all that excitement, all that joy that we feel in our hearts, that's what opened my mind, and I say somebody need to do something for somebody else can experience the same emotions that we are going through with my son's education.
So that was your, what I'm going to call the aha moment, and what I'm challenging all of us to think about as we're looking for jobs, going through transition, are we cognizant of some aha moments? Are we seeing it as things go on around us? The eyes open again. Liz, this one for you. What were the first few steps that you took to start the foundation, and how do you spend your time?
The first steps, I mean, we knew nothing, absolutely nothing. We contacted a local attorney to make us legally a foundation. I think we had something very important happen to us in those early months, about 8 months after Pete was killed. I saw a Nightline broadcast that told me, informed me about these 1 billion people. And they featured a Dr. Richard Malika from the Harvard Program in Refugee Trauma, who was a world expert on this. Well, we knew nothing about this field. It just felt right. So I think it takes a lot of chutzpah to do some of this stuff. We tracked down Dr. Richard Malika, And fortunately, he was willing to see us. And we got ourselves to Cambridge, Mass., and we had a meeting with him, and we started a partnership there. We don't have any expertise in training doctors. Dr. Malika had the expertise. So it was originally structuring us as a legal foundation, and then it was finding the experts. It was leaving our ego at the door. We knew nothing about this field. We had to trust experts. And the other thing was to be collaborative. I mean, we won't go into a country now unless the government is a partner. What I do now, it is a 7-day-a-week job. It is 8, 10, 12 hours a day. I'll get into bed sometimes at, you know, 1 in the morning and say, oh, God, I forgot to do this, and I'll get out of bed and I'll go to the computer. I've taught myself all kinds of computer skills to save money. We give, out of every dollar that's donated to the foundation, $4.90 go to programs because of our partners, and we only take 10 cents out of the dollar for the foundation. I print our own stationery. I buy, you know, paper wholesale. I print the letterhead. I have a few brochures with me if anybody wants one. We print the brochures ourselves. We send thank you notes to everybody who gives us from $5 to $50,000. There is that personal connection. We travel. We set up and organize the conference. I'm 67 years old, and I never thought I would be working the number of hours, the number of days, the number of weeks. I mean, it is constant, but it's also good. Work is good.
And it goes to show you what passion can do. So as we begin to wrap up this part, and any questions we haven't addressed, I will do in the second panel. There are some things. When we talk about it begins with an idea does not always come out of the gate being a passion. And I think that's where people make mistakes. They'll tell me, I'm going and looking for my passion, and I'm so afraid you're going to be looking for that passion. You're going to go to that grave looking for the passion, and there's going to be all these interests lined up that if you had given some time, effort, energy, or money to explore some of those interests, those can turn into a passion. So the passion just doesn't come out to grab you right away. You have to have your eyes open to see it. Second thing is use the resources. Community colleges, people. Third, I would almost say and tell people, get what I call kind of the kitchen type table sounding board, because you heard the word partnerships, you heard collaboration. You also heard, too, I hate to say this, but friends are not always as supportive. And remember, you've got to kind of get them to see. I think other words, too, you are marketing and your own salespeople. And that's really a lot of things that I've seen that are tough, especially for people coming from corporate America today. They want, you know, we're used to here's the promotional ladder. Well, things are changing. There are no enduring companies anymore. So all of a sudden you realize you've got to become the sales, the marketing person. And in this instance, many of you, what you're going to be marketing is yourself. So think about that. And then the customer relationship. When you're with somebody, whether it's a network or whatever type of opportunity, whether it's an exploratory, whether it's an actual meeting, the follow-up. People still get flattered when you handwrite something in a small card and they receive it because they think they're getting an invitation to something. They'll always open it up. The point is that it's really being with the right people, knowing how to make it happen, and daring to put yourself out there. So I want to end by just saying, Liz and Catalina, this world, it's the world for what you're doing, is a better place because the two of you are here with your passion and purpose in your Encore career. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll just take a moment to remove a chair. Get Mike. Oh, that would be great. Okay.
Is the mic on? Okay, great. So We're going to transition into a second panel, and our guests for the second panel are going to include someone who will come out from the back in a moment, Michael Watson, who is the Vice President of Human Resources for the Girl Scouts of the USA. He is a former executive with IBM, who is actually in his own Encore career. Given his expertise in human resources, we thought that he'd be an excellent guest to talk about trends and expectations for work in the nonprofit sector and ways for many of you who may be job seekers to really position yourselves in ways that will work for employers. So we do have a couple minutes here to transition. I just see Michael here. Well, welcome Michael to the stage.
Hello.
Thankful,
Alex. Well, I have to begin by saying Michael and I met in my role at the conference board probably about a year and a half ago now, and I was a very proud person when I said to him, I'm originally from Michigan, and I said I was Troop 810 in Girl Scouts, and I said I had my banner, and I went for all of my badges, and at one year I was actually the number one seller of Girl Scout cookies in Michigan, and it really goes to show how time changes things, because at that time they were 50 cents a box for the Thin Mints, and now they're $3.50. Mm-hmm. So I guess between growing older and pricing today, I'm thrilled. How many Girl Scouts in the audience? Very good. Wow. This happens a lot. See, Michael?
Everywhere I go, same thing.
Yeah, it's really true. So we know that Girl Scout motto and everything, so it works. Okay, how many of you were surprised when you heard all of a sudden now somebody who had been at IBM, I mean, it doesn't get, you know, bigger and, you know, bluer and that, and now they're in a nonprofit? Surprised? No. Ah, interesting. Please. Yell out why. Why not? I love it. See so many of them. Big thing. It's all changing. It's really a happening now. So things that we used to talk about, It's coming. All of a sudden, Michael is living proof it's here. So that's how I'm going to jump into it then. How did you get from IBM to the Girl Scouts? Because to me, that's what I want to know, and I bet a lot of you want to know too. How did he do it? Because that's kind of indicated in some of these questions here. People want to know, how do I get out of corporate America and get into nonprofit?
Well, the thing I'll say is that all of you are fortunate. There's now a Civic Ventures, there's an Encore. All of those things exist now. My Encore career came and found me. I was very, very happy at IBM. I started with IBM as I graduated from college. I wanted to be in human resources, but I started out in sales, did very well in sales. There weren't any human resources opportunities. So I went from there to GE and joined their human resource management program. That's how I got the human resources experience. Then I went from GE to Time Warner and did human resources there. Again, just these dream jobs went after the other. And then I decided I'm going to take a year off. And people thought I was crazy. It was a self-financed sabbatical from my own savings. And I visited a lot of older relatives, traveled around the country, and did several months of very solid volunteer work in the community of schools where I grew up. So I did volunteer work in two community schools and actually sat in the office of my former English teacher, and who was then the principal of one of the schools. So it was a tremendous experience, and it really changed my views on a lot of things. And then I went back to work. And I had a chance to rejoin IBM after being away for 12 years and started back at IBM as if I had never left. They restored my service and everything else. And literally, I said, this is where I'm going to retire, because I loved working at IBM just as I did at GE and Time Warner. Had no intention of leaving. And then one day I got a call from a search firm, Eileen Finch. She gave me a call and said, there's a job at the Girl Scouts as the head of human resources. Would you be interested? And I said, Girl Scouts, I mean, literally, do they have jobs?
I mean, other than selling cookies.
That was my image. I mean, everyone had seen the Girl Scout cookies. Everyone had seen Girl Scout volunteers. I had never met a Girl Scout employee in my entire life. And so I very quickly said, okay, well, I have some people I can refer you to, and started giving her names. And she said, well, I really want to see if you're interested. I said, no, maybe when I retire. She called a friend of mine, called me back. And she kept persisting, and I finally said, you know what, maybe when I retire, maybe I'll do something like this. So I'll just go in for an exploratory, but I'm not going to consider this seriously because I love my job at IBM. I went there, met the CEO, met the staff members, saw what they were doing, and said, oh my goodness, this is a real organization in terms of their infrastructure and what they're trying to accomplish. I had done volunteer work in every job I had had since I graduated from college, and I volunteered at college. It was part of who I was. It was very important to me to try to make a difference. So all of a sudden, when they made the offer, I had to think, okay, well, do I want to make a difference 5-10 hours a week, maybe 15 hours a week, squeezing it into my jobs, or do I want to do a job where I have a chance to impact the lives of 3 million young people? And it was the hardest decision I could ever make, because here I am at IBM, this great organization with the stock options and everything else. But then again, one of my sole driver is I want to make a difference.
Let's stop for a minute on that. This is great. See, all of a sudden when you said make a difference, when I asked you how many of you know it really motivates you, mm-hmm. So you're somebody who knew. You also, on some of these questions alluded to, you've been doing volunteer work.
Yeah.
How many of you do volunteer work? How many of you want to go into a nonprofit? Okay. Trying to begin to see the connections here. How many of you would never have thought that you might be interested in going to a nonprofit because you just see yourself too much on the corporate side? A few. Okay. All right, so this is what I want to know about. So the recruiter calls, you get talked into it. Have any of you ever been, somebody wanted you to go on a job interview and you said, I don't think it's me. I don't want to go. Okay, did you go? You did. How many of you didn't go, though? Oh, okay. Honest here. So you went, even though with some trepidation, and you were loving what you were doing.
Correct.
Okay. When the offer came then, what was your criteria? Because this is what I hear a lot from people. I want to go into, you know, into a nonprofit, but how will I know if it's right for me?
My criteria was simple. Where could I, as I spent my time, make the most difference? And I had to trade going to colleges and speaking to students, going to elementary schools and speaking to students, doing volunteer work a certain number of hours a week and impacting individuals. Or do I work for an organization whose sole purpose is to develop young people? That was the criteria. And that's how I ended up making the decision. Where would I make the most difference?
So it really went back to you. Where can I, you know, as you said, make the difference? Now, people say this. Did you do a pro and con list?
Oh, of course.
Okay. Because this is really it. It's taking it from your head and really writing these things out. What were the things that, to make a difference? It was human resources. Other things going on in the nonprofit? We heard that people are nicer in nonprofits.
That was not part of my criteria.
Okay.
I had no image of what nonprofit people were like because I didn't really know a lot of nonprofit employees.
Oh, you really didn't, even in
a
lot of the experience. Okay. All right. Now, so you've got this unbelievable job at IBM. What was the time frame that it took you to really go on the interview? Over what amount of time?
This happened over about a month period between
squeezing
in meetings.
That's fast.
And literally after the second interview, they made the offer, which I wasn't expecting. So then I was forced into having to make a decision.
Okay. Would you say, let's go back a bit, too, that when the recruiter called you, she knew about you. She mm-hmm. knew your credentials. One of the points that we were talking earlier is, as you go on this job hunt and even thinking about, even if you're in a new job, it isn't just about who you know. It's who knows you. Because that's one of the big areas, I think, that we just don't realize. It's somebody else that's going to tell somebody else. He or she is really terrific. And I don't know if people... Would you call yourself a big networker beforehand or anything?
I never think about networking. Okay. I just happen to know a lot of people over time. But if I look back at my career, I can say that the last time I looked for a job was in 1985. Every other job after that, with Time Warner, with everything else... Someone called. It was through a search firm, someone, they talked to somebody I knew, et cetera. So
okay, and I think that's important because it doesn't matter where you are on this transition continuum right now. I think that we all have a lot of people that we've worked with in our network. They're not always the frontliners, though.
Right.
Sometimes it's two or three back that somebody goes, oh, I worked with you and you were really terrific. Sometimes we just think about that person on the front line, but there's other people deeper into our system. It doesn't have to be the complete LinkedIn model, but the reality is there's somebody there. Now, so you're going through this, IBM as a certain persona. Were there any comments from friends or family that thought you were crazy to be leaving IBM and going into not only a nonprofit, but the Girl Scouts?
Well, I will say that my teachers, you know, from elementary school and junior high, they said, oh, this really fits his values. It's very nice. They were very pleased. The people who I knew from corporate life, the most frequent comment was, are you crazy? And one person literally said, okay, he took this year off, and now he's working, and now I think he's selling cookies. So they had no idea of what I was doing. They thought I was going to try to be a permanent volunteer. And because, again, most of the people, I worked in New York. I worked at Time Warner at Rockefeller Center. I had never known that Girl Scouts headquarters was here in New York. So most people I'm in the circles of, at GE, et cetera, the only employees from the nonprofit that you run into are from the United Way, or maybe the American Red Cross. But outside of that, no sense that there are millions of jobs in the nonprofit sector. So most people thought I had lost it.
So in other words, marquee names sometimes can stop us if we're looking for, you know, marquee clients or opportunities. And we don't always look kind of below the surface to see what else is out there and what else is going on. Well, you know, we talked about misperceptions about the nonprofit sector. Will you elaborate for this audience? Because some hands went up saying, yeah, they would like to look at the nonprofit. But do you think people do have have the wrong ideas about what goes on in the nonprofit arena?
Yes. There are several. One is they think that you're instantly going into poverty, that you have to move into your parents' home, and that you'll have to share that small space with a neighbor or something to survive. That's not true. I mean, nonprofits know that we're trying to attract higher caliber talent, so the salaries have been increasing from that standpoint. And I can say right now, we have people from who worked at Macy's, people who worked at Exxon, people who worked at GE and IBM. So we have a pretty good variety because we need those kinds of skills, and people increasingly want to make a difference. The second thing is I think people don't have any idea how large the nonprofit sector is. There are literally over a million nonprofits, obviously of varying sizes, and over 10 million people work in the nonprofit sector. I didn't have any clue of any of that when I was working at IBM. So I think people misperceive the size and also the variety of jobs. Almost any job that you can do in a corporation, in many cases there's a similar job or a job that uses similar skills somewhere in a nonprofit. I mean, in Girl Scouts, we have accountants, we have finance people, we have marketing people, we have public relations people, we have human resources people. And then there are specific nonprofit jobs, you know, fund development, et cetera, but there are skills that are transferable from the for-profit sector that can be applied in the nonprofit sector. So I think those are the major misperceptions.
I have to share with you, in my former life, several years ago, I'd had my own executive search firm. And one day, somebody wanting to leave corporate America called me, and she said, Jerry, I really want to work for a nonprofit. And I said, well, you know, why? And that was her first comment. She goes, they're nicer. I said, they're people. And I said, and you're driven by budgets and the project management, a grant mentality, you have a board. But beyond that, I said, what is your area? And she said to me, marketing. I said, no, what is your interest? And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, the nonprofit, and correct me, is, I said, you're driven by what the passion or what you think you like. I said, is it animals? Is it, you know, illiteracy? Is it children? Is it mental health? What is it? That was the first thing. I think that she was just looking at the nonprofit concept and didn't really realize how much it ties back to what really turns you on. I mean, as we see the best of the Encore careers, they're driven by the heart, they're driven by the passion, and that could be the same thing if you're thinking about going into a nonprofit or doing, you know, work, even consulting work or something like that, or project management. So I think that there was the surprise for her. The second thing is, how important would you say it is today that people are active volunteers if they are really contemplating going into a nonprofit?
I think it's critical. I mean, even though there's more and more people coming from the for-profit sector, there are still some people in the nonprofit sector who've only been in the nonprofit sector who have a suspicion about people coming from the for-profit sector. And some of the stereotypes are, oh, they're arrogant. They think they know everything. They will ask for too much money. They want stock options. They'll leave as soon as the economy turns around. All those stereotypes. It is that commitment that you show in your personal life. There's two things. One, it shows that you're committed to something. Secondly, it gives you an understanding of the sector. And third, it makes that comfort level in terms of looking at you. And you can also build up skills that you didn't have before. I knew someone at GE who worked, he did human resources. On the weekends, he was a radio interviewer. Interviewed all kinds of people, and he had done that so much, he literally qualified for a second career. So if there's an area that you would love to work in a second career, volunteer in it. And you'll build that expertise and you'll build your resume that way. And those things count in the nonprofit sector.
I really wanted to stress this because talking earlier to some of you, I know that the nonprofit is on your mind, but it's also the additional thing about whatever it takes. What are you willing to do, especially during tough market times? To me, it's a way to really give yourself a competitive edge. A friend here in the city had taken a job at, I think it was the Children's Aid Society. It was a volunteer opportunity. But when she was there, she put herself out and she said, you know, I have a financial background. I could help you with this. Well, the reality is it did roll right into a very interesting paid senior job. So sometimes what we have to do, I think, is really put ourselves out there, not know for sure where it's going to go, and then see what happens. What about, do you think it helps if people are also on boards of organizations?
It helps incredibly because, one, you really understand the workings in a much different way. You understand what the budgets are like. You understand what the trade-offs are like. You get a chance to meet the senior management. And actually, over time, I've seen a number of people from boards actually end up being hired because the board is familiar with them. They know their commitment. And they're willing to take that risk to say, well, this person knows what we're about because they've been on a similar nonprofit board or they've been on a particular organization's board. So I think that experience is, and again, people get to know you as an individual. You're just not a resume at that point. So I would definitely encourage you to consider nonprofit boards.
Right. Tell us what's going on in that overall nonprofit arena. At the conference board, we've been doing some work over there and really showing that it's an area that people do want to go into. I think you alluded to it, how you can transfer skills. Somebody that I know from Colgate, and she had been in marketing, and finally she said, where am I going to go next? And I said to her, have you thought of the nonprofit? She and I know each other because of our love of animals. So all of a sudden she said, well, I never thought about it. So I said, we've got BIDAWI here in the city. You've got the ASPCA. You've got the Humane Society. So sometimes I don't know if we always see the connection between our interests and, you know, or passions and some of those competencies and skills. And do you know, have any of your friends gone into nonprofits since you have?
Yes. They have to see someone do it and come out alive. That's what people are waiting for. So several people have done so after I did it because they said, okay, well, he did it. He's still eating. He's not on the street homeless or anything. But I think some people need to see. This was 9 years ago when I did it, so it was not a typical thing. But I think people are feeling more comfortable with that, and they're starting to see people who've done it. And that's making people a lot more comfortable with the idea and concept.
With that, great. So tell us. Are you hiring? Not just you at the Girl Scouts, but I mean, I'm sure that people want to know, are there job opportunities in nonprofits today? What's going on?
Well, the nonprofit sector is facing the same kinds of challenges the rest of the country is. So there's reductions in reserves, there's reductions in donations, all kinds of things. But there's always some level of hiring everywhere. We'll give you a tip sheet later in terms of where to look and everything else, but start doing your homework now, I would say. Because even in tough times, at some point, people have to be hired to do the variety of jobs that exist. And one of the concerns that the nonprofit sector has is that we have the same demographics as the rest of the country. A significant portion of our workers may be delayed because of the stock portfolio declines, but eventually people will start either retiring or dying at their desk. And so one way, didn't mean to say it that way, perhaps.
Nice but, image.
But literally, one of the concerns that we have is there enough talent within our organizations to take over the leadership roles when these individuals who are currently leading the organizations retire? And our analysis says, like, this is across the sector, there are not. So we know that if we don't do something very serious, and we've been working on that, trying to provide people with more information about the nonprofit sector, because we will not be able to survive and provide the best services unless we can get the best talent. So as soon as things turn around, you're going to see a big uptick in terms of recruiting.
So in a way, that really will be an outstanding type of encore career. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, you could really target it to whatever your passion is.
Yep.
And also, there's the, is it the Nonprofit Center down on 15th and 5th Avenue? The Foundation Center. Okay, too, that I always try to tell people. I don't know if we put that on the tip list that we're going to give you for people to start, you know, getting ideas. Michael, you've alluded to some of this, but you said for people to start to do their homework. And one of my questions was going to be, how do people set themselves up for that position? Can you be definitive, define homework a little bit?
Well, what I'm saying is nonprofit is too general. as Jerry said earlier, what are you particularly interested in? So know that. You know, is it animals? Is it young people? Is it older people? Is it healthcare? Is it defense issues? Know what your cause is. And then once you know what that is, then do the research and say, okay, what nonprofits provide services in these areas? And then do research on those nonprofits, because each nonprofits are not the same. Just GE is as different from IBM as Girl Scouts is as different from Boys and Girls Club. They're all different. So you want to choose an organization where you'll be able to succeed. Knowing what the culture of that organization is critical to your being able to succeed in a certain place. If you're someone who really likes to work on consensus, et cetera, and you work at a nonprofit that's very non-consensus focused, you're not going to be happy, you're not going to be successful, even though you believe in the cause. So to the degree that you can, find people who either volunteered or work at that nonprofit. Ask them what it's like. What kind of people succeed? What kind of people don't succeed? What are the resources of the organization? All this stuff is available online, because you don't want to go somewhere that's financially unstable, just like you wouldn't go to certain organizations now that have shown themselves to be unstable. So that's the kind of homework. How strong is the organization? What do they do? Who its leaders are? And what kind of culture it is?
Great. And are there, I know NYU has some classes in the nonprofit arena. Is that something that people should consider going back to school for anything in the nonprofit area?
I think if it means expanding your education, why not? Or if it means giving you a different skill set or strengthening a skill set that you think will be valuable, it never hurts to acquire additional education. But I will say that the contacts that you make, the volunteer work, those are going to be the two strongest things that will help you. If you have just a degree, but no experience, no volunteer experience, and no successes to talk of, that's going to hurt your chances.
Right. So start to stack the deck in your own
right.
Okay. One of the first ones is that I know that there are many people who thought that they were going to have encore careers, and then the economy and the market and a few things, you know, changed. So answering that question, would you say just stick with it or try to start volunteering, stay in your current job, and then plan on making a change in the future? Or what would your advice be?
I would say a combination of both. One, continue to look, because, again, there's always, whether it's hiring freezes or whatever, there's always hiring going on. It might not be the same volume as before, but you might miss that one opportunity. So always keep looking. Second thing is keep preparing. That's the volunteer work. That's the homework. That's building your network, talking to your friends, talking to alumni from school who you know, finding people who work in the sector. And several people I know are doing that now, and they're actually finding opportunities that way.
And as Cranes, I'm going to say, too, has been doing some great listing of who's hiring. They've right. great columns in there. And also offering so many different things, you know, in a way like today, what the library is doing, so you can come and get new ideas and, you know, different, you know, thoughts and thinking. And don't discard anyone. I've heard too many people lately say, too, that, oh, I don't think they have any good ideas. And I'm thinking, you have no idea. So right. get everybody, you know, really in that filter there. Mm-hmm. So that was the first one. And what I've said, and when people will say to me, well, I thought I was going to have my encore career now. I thought I was going to be able to rewire. The reality is, it's really where you're going, Michael. One, I said, stick with your knitting if you've got a job mm-hmm. right now. Stay with those competencies and skills. But if you know you want to make that change in the future, you begin to say, what am I doing to get myself there? I mean, that's it, whether it's, each day you're doing something different, you're networking with somebody else, and do the exploratories to really find out what's going on. But I think we are seeing people getting a little bit, just not being out there as much doing some of the volunteer work, and I'm the biggest proponent. During a time of change, I think everyone should be doing volunteer work because it takes the focus off yourself. But go to something that really could set you up for the future. If you really would love to be animals, or like somebody said to me in her encore career, I think it's something like a vet's assistant. And I said, then go up to the ASPCA right. and walk the animals to see if you really like it, or even if you're allergic to it. I mean, you begin to put yourself in that. Because a lot of people have dreams, and they get out there and go, whoa, this isn't exactly what I thought. Well, on that, then, how do you attract high power people, would you say, for a board of a new nonprofit? Whoa.
Well, what we
do. Are you recruiting Michael here?
What we do is we go and ask them. We have a very active board development or recruiting committee, National Nominating Committee. And they are able to go out there, and once they explain the cause of your organization, if people identify with it, it is not a problem recruiting people. We have people on our board from, goodness, from GE, from all kinds of places, and it was not difficult to recruit them. It's just a matter of, do they have the time to commit to the board? So I think it's always a good time. And I think also, if you look at people on the for-profit side, they're trying to think of how can they make a difference as well. They might not need to, they might not want to leave their job right now, but they can make a difference by being on a board and helping to guide an organization that makes a difference in an area that they care about. So I think it's possible.
Okay. Now I'm going to share something on a board, and Michael, you may not like this, but somebody I know, and this was from an advertising standpoint and communications, really wanted to get to somebody because he had a great idea and he thought from a that if he could meet with this person, he could really convince and sell. Now, I happened to find out that this man was on the board of a foundation or of an organization, and I said, go and get involved on the program committee. Be there so at least you have some face time. Mm-hmm. You can meet the person. You're giving back. It wasn't his number one choice, I must admit, of organization. So he was doing it with a little bit of an ulterior motive there, but he did meet him, and it did turn out, and he got very much involved with that organization. So the reality is, it was he kind of went through a back doorway doing something that he thought could really resonate. It did. So sometimes that's when I asked you earlier, how many of you are really thinking out of the box and being creative and trying to do something different during these economic times? Because I do think there are a variety of different ways to go. And even asking people, somebody I know asked his barber, and he said, I have, you know, an idea. I'm looking for a job opportunity. And the barber has some very interesting clients. And he was able to put his client with another client. So what I said earlier is, mm-hmm. Don't discount anyone, anytime, anyplace. Now, Michael, you alluded to this, but we do have a few questions on this one. There are many people who would love to go into nonprofits. Mm-hmm. But because there is such a market, or at least out there, perception of a major financial difference. Now, not that we really want to put you on the spot and say, how much of a cut did you have to take? We won't. What can people expect if they're really taking a look in a nonprofit arena? Is there a place where they can go to get a sense of salary ranges so they would know what they're getting into?
There's a lot of nonprofit surveys. One of the things you want to take a look at, there's a publication called the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Once a year, they publish information about the top 400 nonprofits. And they publish in that publication the salaries of the CEOs of the top 400 organizations. So if you look at an organization and the CEO's salary is $20,000, you could probably guess that their senior VP of marketing is less than $20,000. But you will find that the salaries have gone up over the years. So there's some very competitive salaries because they know that's what it's going to take to attract the kind of talent that they want. The second thing you have to know as well, you're not going to have the stock options, so that's going to be a difference. You're not going to have, but again, if you're in certain places, that doesn't mean anything now because stock options are underwater. So increasingly, though, the competition has become more competitive. But again, it all is driven by the size, in many cases, of the nonprofit and their resources. So it is going to vary, just like the compensation will vary from company A versus company B. So do your homework from that standpoint, and you'll get a sense of what the salaries are.
Because what Michael is really saying is that when you want to be attracting good people, you know, is it you'll pay what you have to. I mean, there are definitely ranges and have limits on this. But don't just exclude yourself from pursuing this arena because you think or you heard that the salary range isn't there. Go in there and find out. But I think a lot of it, again, is passion-driven. When people, you know, Michael, you know, beams in that, but every time you meet people, they go, yes, I may be working harder than I imagined. There's a board, mm-hmm. There are different bosses, but at the end of the day, just like we saw really with Liz and Catalina, you feel like you're making such a difference. You are really leaving legacy. I mean, this really is the whole concept of the Encore career here, isn't it?
It is.
You know? Well, what would you say to somebody who is all of a sudden, this is almost like just because you and I both have corporate and different backgrounds, to people who are in transition today, that all of a sudden, you know, we open up the paper and we know that people have been downsized in transition. What are some thoughts that we would want to share and help people think about, not just going into the nonprofit, but how do we get through this from and not get depressed?
I think as you're looking, that's obviously a given. But the thing, as you can tell now, there's a lot more competition for every job that's available out there. So the key thing you have to think about is, how do you distinguish yourself from the competition? And volunteering in the nonprofit sector can be one of those ways. You can develop a different network by doing so. You can develop a different set of skills by doing so. In fact, increasingly in corporations, they're looking for people who are community-minded. And so you can make yourself a more attractive candidate by your volunteer work. And you can also often meet people who are in various corporations through your nonprofit volunteering work who you wouldn't have met ordinarily. So I think making yourself distinctive is the most important thing that you can do, not only for this recessionary period, but for the rest of your career. Because again, I think with the slowness of the economy, there's always going to be a lot of choices of people for every job that's open, and you want to stand out, and you want to have the biggest network that you can have, and the most skills that you can develop, and the most distinguished accomplishments that you can develop. And the nonprofit sector can be one of those ways in which you can do that, and I would encourage you to do it.
One of the second things, too, is take a look at your network, and do you have a variety of age cohorts? Mm-hmm. I've seen too many people have friends all the same ages. And all of a sudden, if that person's in an organization and they were your client, they get downsized. Your client is now out the door, and you don't have anybody to turn to. So I would say get everybody, you know, from if you're a boomer, get all the way down to X and Y, because we can all, God bless you, learn from each other. And I think that's one of the things that people just aren't realizing. I'm meeting too many people who all of their friends are the same ages. They're going through all of the same experiences. And sometimes, you know, it's the one-up. If you think it's bad, you won't believe my story. It's really bad. And I think that there are things that we can learn from younger people, and that they can definitely, you know, learn from us as well. Michael, what about this area I keep hearing? I did a program up at Yale, and Yale had said, boy, for Encore Careers, I'd love it if people went into development. Do we have a shortage of fundraisers in the United States?
It is the hottest job in the nonprofit sector. And it's a job that requires an outgoing nature, sales skills, presentation skills, and the like. The shortage is dramatic. And because of that, the salaries are higher. And if you have any experience in that area, you can find a job very easily, especially when times are tough. There's one individual I knew who... she literally was a stay-at-home individual, and she had done that for 15-plus years. And all of a sudden, there was a divorce, and she had to find a job. Well, because she had volunteered on all these boards and everything else and had done all this fundraising, she was able to find a development job. And that development job, within 2 years, led to being a CEO of a nonprofit with a six-figure salary. And here's someone who had not been in the workplace for 15 years. That's usually suicide from a corporate standpoint. But because she had done all this volunteering, and when she went into the job, because she had this vast network from all these corporations, because guess who goes to fundraisers? All these people from various corporations. She can call any company almost anywhere and say, I'd like to meet with you and talk about my organization. That was not her plan. It was not her plan to get divorced. She wasn't doing it for that reason, but it all ended up working out for the better. So fundraising, I would definitely, if you have any interest in that area, pursue it, whether it's at a nonprofit, a smaller one, in your volunteer work, working at a college, anywhere you can get that experience. You will make yourself employable for the rest of your life.
And we were saying to people from biz dev, from business development, from, you know, sales, marketing, any kind of communications, the development, I can't think of the actual name of the association here in New York City. I think they meet once a month. Go mm-hmm. there and see if you can just go and start to network and find out what is this all about. And I think down at NYU, if I'm not mistaken, they do have certification in this area. But that's one of the biggest cries that I've heard. And then you can link it with your passion, and then it turns out to be that Encore career. But what is the greatest thing? To go into an organization, meet with an individual, go to a donor, just really when you think about what Liz and Catalina are doing, it ties it all back together. You could be the development officer, but going forward then and asking for money, but to do something that really resonates with you, I just can't imagine it gets much better than that. So are there any last questions from the audience? Have we addressed here? Sir?
You address the issue of knowing other languages, given the fact that the United States is having the greatest immigration, especially from developing countries?
I would say that if you want to distinguish yourself in a career and open up opportunities, having a second or a third language I would say is critical. It's a deficit that we have across this country, and those who are able to speak a second or third language, it expands their opportunities both in the nonprofit side and especially in corporate, because more of our business is coming internationally. So if you can pick up a second language, that will help you. Even if you're a teacher, teachers who are able to speak a second language will be able to teach bilingual classes. They'll have more options. They'll be able to manage different kinds of programs. So it will make you stand out. Those are the things that will distinguish you from those you might be competing against.
And even when you think about it, too, what it does, if you're older and learning a language, too, it's unbelievable mm-hmm. for the brain. So it could yep. have a secondary impact from the whole cognitive skill. So you can really do two things. It is the real meaning of the word rewiring. The next question I saw, yes.
I think the way it would help you is that you have the skills of having done it already. I mean, if you go to someone asking for money from here, in anywhere in this country, they'll look at what you've done before and say, oh, well, you've managed the foundation already. So be able to state your accomplishments in terms of how much money did you raise? What difference did you make? What outcomes did you achieve through your foundation? What impact did you have on people's lives? And so it will help you.
And I think the way things are broken out of the Foundation Center, too, there are so many things that are giving from a global standpoint that it's actually fairly easy to target, from grants and it. And I remember the one more. Yes.
We just had a lesson from the Obama campaign on how to use new media, social networking to make a difference in the real physical world. What else, if anything, that this technology has brought has changed anything? Otherwise, couldn't we have done the same event 10 years ago with the same content? What would you say different today because these things exist? What new opportunities, what changes?
I think that technology is going to change work across this country, but especially in nonprofits, because we're dealing with limited resources, so anything that can help us use resources more effectively will help. Anyone who has those skills, they're going to stand out in the nonprofit sector because we don't have the same kinds of resources in terms of that talent as, let's say, Exxon or an IBM or an Intel. So if you're able, in the nonprofit sector, one of the things I will say that's an advantage, you get a chance to create a lot of new systems because there's a gap sometimes between the resources that we have versus the resources in the private sector. So if you want to be creative and make a difference, the nonprofit sector could be a great place where you can come in and say, hey, let me help you use technology in a different way. Let me help you use what I've learned at Intel or Cisco or on the Obama campaign. It is a welcome asset. So, yes.
Now, let me add on to this, though. When you say for the 10 years, a lot of the work that we do, because as having this title of senior advisor at the Conference Board of the Mature Workforce, one of the areas that we see as the toughest is if you're not keeping up with your technology right. skills. If you don't know what Twitter is, if you're not out there, saying, I understand blogging. I know all of a sudden, we're laughing because boomers seem to be taking over Facebook now. but the truth is one of the reasons that we did the second edition of Don't Retire, Rewire was one of the stories that I heard, and it was a 59-year-old man, and he said, I don't want to use a BlackBerry on this job. And his boss was saying, well, this comes with the territory. So when he told me, so what do you think? I said, well, you're basically saying you don't want the job. He said, what do you mean? I said, but that is the WIT, whatever it takes. And he said, well, I don't want to be beholden. And I said, my BlackBerry gives me total freedom. I'm looking at it as freedom, that I could be sitting here and all of a sudden in a meeting, I don't have to be in my office. But it was the perception that all of a sudden I was being tied down to something.
But unemployment can be freedom.
You're right, but unfortunately there's another F word involved with the freedom, financial. That's why the unemployment isn't so good. So I would say to all of you, where are you on your computer skills? Where are you on your leadership skills? Have you worked with younger bosses and as well as older bosses? One of the things we put in the book and said, don't use this phraseology when people say, well, in my day, and basically it's no one cares about your day. You have to just say all of a sudden, this is what I did on this is on my job. This is how I can contribute. When all of a sudden Michael was saying, all of a sudden it's more competitive, and I just tell people, you're the product. You are the product. How do you look? What are you saying? When we sent somebody, this was several years ago now, from the search firm, and he had just gotten back from trekking in Nepal.
And he was 58, and he was going for a big senior VP of sales job with a lot of road warrior type of travel. And I said, when you go on the interview, I said, I want you to let them know that you just came back trekking in Nepal. And he said, why? I said, because not everybody 58 years old can be trekking in Nepal. And what that says is you've got energy, you've got enthusiasm, you've got stamina, you've got all the things they're looking for. Because remember, one of the fears and the factor that comes through this, the older, and remember, what is the what does this country say is the age of a mature worker? 40. People are stunned. They go, oh, no, I must have misunderstood. It's 40. Because in 1967, when the employment, Age Discrimination Employment Act went in, 40 was perceived as old. Well, now all of a sudden you're living another 20 to 25 years after the age of 65. So I say that is filled with opportunity. But remember, at 65, something also kicks in the United States. Social Security. So you can see what a conundrum it is and why it's so hard and why we all have to be the best we can be when we go out there on this job opportunity, because a lot of people that do want to hire you have the skills say, how long of a runway does she really have? How long does he really want to be working? We have to demonstrate we want to be there. And if you're doing something you love, it's very easy to come through. That's why setting yourself up, knowing what you want, what really motivates you, that's the rewiring process that gets you to that Encore career, whether it's in a nonprofit, whether it's starting your own, whether it's in corporate America. So, Michael, thank you for sharing all your information.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I want to mention a couple things. If you want to find out what a blog is, you can visit encore.org. It's a website started by Civic Ventures, and it's a place where people can talk to one another, read about policy changes, things that are affecting the job market for older workers, and a place to network. So please do visit encore.org. I'd also just like to end by stating a few things. We have a few books here, one called Encore, which was written by the founder of the Purpose Prize and Civic Ventures, as well as Jerry Sedlar's book, Don't Retire, Rewire. And I want to make sure that if you did not get a raffle ticket, that you raise your hand, did anyone not get a raffle ticket? Okay, great. So a couple people. I'll hold the raffle outside in about 5 or 10 minutes, and we're going to give away some of these books here. What we're going to do now is just invite all of you to stay with us if you like to have some time to network and converse. We have some food and drinks outside of this auditorium. And when you head out, you'll notice that there are signs in the foyer. And they mention areas like education, the environment, international development. And if you have any interests, please go congregate by the sign and you'll meet people who have like interests. So if anyone doesn't have a raffle ticket, please come up to the front and we'll be sure to give you your raffle. And I'm going to end by just letting you all know that Purpose Prize nominations for these $100,000 prizes are due on Thursday, March 5th. So if any of you have anyone in mind, I'd love to hear. So please come talk to me and I'll let you know how you can nominate and you can self-nominate. Well, again, thank you for coming. Enjoy. Hope you network, meet lots of people. Thank you.